The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Between now and 6 o'clock, we're going to discuss how our politicians can fix our health service. We're joined by Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin, Stephen Donnelly of Fianna Fáil, Roisin Shortall of the Social Democrats. But I'm going to start with the Business Post's health editor, Susan Mitchell. And is it an impossible task, given that every health minister for the last 20 years has been promising to fix our health system and we continue to have enormous problems which seem to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger? Is this a task that's beyond everyone?
No, in a word. I think it's clear that it's a very difficult task. We've obviously had a lot of different health ministers in who have, many of whom have tried their best, some of whom actually wanted that job. For example, we've Mary Harney, the former leader of the Progressive Democrats, James Riley, a former Fine Gael minister who also wanted the health portfolio. And they've all struggled to make real inroads, particularly in respect of access.
Why?
I suppose one of the key issues that keeps coming up from different health analysts and people working in the system is that we have a very hospital-centric model, and we have been very slow at changing that and at improving access for patients outside of hospitals. And hospitals are the most expensive place to deliver care.
Do we also have an enormous amount of vested interests who protect their own position within the system to the detriment of the overall bigger picture?
I think we certainly do have vested interests. I mean, I'm a vested interest as somebody who has used the public health service and somebody who will use the public health service. We're probably all vested interests. But if what you're referring to, Matt, is more, you know, our
unions.
I'm talking
about more of people who are working within the systems, unions, also management, administration.
Yeah.
That if people are in a position where they're comfortable doing what they do, that they don't necessarily want to change, that they actually then obstruct efforts to change.
I think it's fair to say that it's been very difficult to get change over the line for health service managers, and when I'm to, and indeed to get health service managers to change. And we do have a lot of examples of this. Like, just to give you one basic example that listeners might understand if they're not working in the health service, you know, every other country or almost every other English speaking country have theatre assistants, operating theatre assistants working in their health service. Back in 2016, when Leo Varadkar was health minister, he was going to launch a pilot programme here. Now, at the moment, we have nurses doing that job in our operating theatres, and we find it difficult to recruit and retain nurses. So the international figures or the comparative figures suggest that we're more reliant on nurses than other jurisdictions because we haven't possibly introduced other grades. The INMO, the nursing union, was vehemently opposed to that move, and it never happened.
Okay, do we have two hospital beds?
Well, the figures, the OECD figures, would suggest that we do. We have a low proportion of beds per 1,000 population compared to other countries. However, when you look at the figures in the UK, they're quite similar to us, and yet they don't have the same waiting lists for elective care or for planned care.
Do we have fewer beds in our hospitals than we had a decade ago?
Yes, we do. Now, in fairness to Fine Gael and to the current government, they have increased the number of beds, but it has been very, very slow.
Why so?
They haven't had the money. You know,
or
when
is
they
it
first...
a question of the not being able to recruit the nurses and the doctors? Because if you have a bed, you have to have a team of staff to operate the bed effectively, don't you?
Yeah, that's definitely a factor. But there's also what we have seen is we've seen a big increase in terms of our health spending. So if you look back, say, at figures from 2015, you'll see that we were spending about 13.5 billion on health. That has increased by a couple of billion since. But actually the capital spend or the amount of money that we have spent on infrastructure has been the increase has been very, very low. Most of the money has gone into current expenditure. In other words, pay, because that's what tends to eat up most of current expenditure. And we're not alone there.
OK, before I go to the politicians, Sláintecare, right? In your assessment as a longstanding health journalist who talks to people on a regular basis, who looks at all the documents, goes through them, is it a good and workable plan?
I think it's a really good vision, and that's mainly what Sláinte Cair was asked to do. The politicians, and both Stephen and Roisin were on the committee that devised this plan. Roisin chaired the committee because it was obviously devised by a cross-party group of TDs. In principle, the idea is really laudable. What they want to do is provide better access, a less hospital-centric model, which should hopefully reduce costs, and also enable better access to primary care. And access, when I say access, in other words, half the population pay for primary care, for GPs at the moment. We're the only country, I think, in Western Europe where that happens. They want to eradicate that. The difficulty, I think, with Sláinte Cair is there is a plan, and it has been costed. I think it's fair to say that it's been loosely costed. But what we haven't seen yet from the department, or more importantly, from the implementation office, is a very clear, detailed plan going through year by year, in which it says we need to hire X number of doctors, you know, Y number of nurses. This is the number of beds we need based on, you know, well, actually, the beds, to be fair, the government did commission a report on that. But there's still a lot of unknowns with Sláinte Cair in terms of the sequencing.
But last night, and just before I bring the others in, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was here in the studio, and I put it to him about the non-implementation of Sláinte Cair, or the very, very slow implementation of it, and about how people like Professor Anthony Staines in Dublin City University, who's a Fine Gael member, said you need a specific fund put aside apart from the ongoing running of the HSE fund to actually finance and bring about the change. And Leo Varadkar didn't want to hear about that. Why not?
Because I suppose when they're in government, they have a huge number of competing interests vying for funding. And from what I can remember, the Sláinte Cair report actually outlined that about 3 billion would be needed in transitional funding to help the service actually move in the direction that it needed to move. And to, for example, to fund better diagnostics, more diagnostics, where we have a huge shortage and there's huge bottlenecks
in
hospitals.
But could that be a good investment to make, Susan, in that if you make that investment, then you're able to run the system for the 17 billion a year, rather than finding that every year you have to add an extra billion or 2 billion and the bill keeps going up?
Well, I think what we've seen, like, consistently in health is umpteen reports over the years. You know, we had hospital co-location, then we had a plan for universal health insurance. There have been so many different proposals. We had these hospital groups established. Now that plan is being, you know, revised, and we're getting these RICOs, or regional integrated care organisations. So there's been so much tinkering with the structure of the service, but actually very little change on the ground for many people. But, you know, you asked me earlier, Matt, and I'm just conscious that I didn't give you, you know, you asked, is it doable? Yes, it is doable, because if every other country in Europe can provide a health service that is much more accessible than ours, there's no reason why we can't do it.
Roisin Shortall, how much would it cost? How much do you think does the state really need to spend every year to deliver an efficient, effective health service that people are satisfied with?
OK, so all those figures are set out in the Sláinte Cair report. It's pretty detailed costings. You can't, you know, work it out up to 10 years ahead exactly, clearly, because there's a whole lot of moving parts in it. But what we're saying is, the first thing is that there's a need for a catch-up fund or a transition fund. Susan has already said that, you know, over the last number of years, there has been very little capital investment in health. You know, we don't have enough hospital beds. We don't have sufficient numbers of primary care centres. The whole e-health programme, for example, which is critical to delivering integrated care cost-effectively, has to happen. So we've said that there's a need for €3 billion to be spent in capital investment over a six-year period. So that's about €500,000 a year in capital investment to catch up and create the additional capacity that's needed.
And that's on top of the €17 billion a year funding.
Well, can I just say this about the Sláinte Cair funding? So there's that €3 billion over a six-year period. In addition to that, there's a requirement for an extra between €400 and €500 million to extend access to care, so that we don't have cost as a barrier to people accessing care. And that is the case at the moment. And, you know, as Susan has said, in every other European country, you know, the idea of paying to see a GP is unheard of. The idea of what we have in this country, where nearly half the people pay a health tax by way of private health insurance, and then on top of that, you still have to pay to see a consultant or for an MRI or whatever, like, that is unheard of in other places. So cost is a huge barrier, and it is about, you know, the whole idea of Staunch Care is ensuring that we have a universal single tier, not two-tier as we have at the moment, which gives rise to, you know, large numbers of people working in the health service being involved for profit. We need to end the thing of for-profit medicine and have a universal single-tier health service as they have in most other European countries.
OK, Stephen Donnelly, is Fianna Fáil committed, if you get into power after the election, implementing Sláinte Care as has been set out, agreed on a cross-party basis at an Oireachtas committee?
Absolutely. Fianna Fáil co-authored it, and what we did yesterday was lay out what we would do with the first 5 years. Remember, Sláinte Care is very ambitious. It's absolutely the right vision. It's the right pathway. We need a single-tier public health system. We don't want this two-tier system. And what each of the parties is doing at the moment is saying, OK, well, in the first 5 years, there's the fiscal space is 11 billion. Here's what we would spend and here's where our priorities are. So, yeah, absolutely. And as well as that, Matt, we have to get over this sort of implementation deficit disorder that's going on, because Susan's absolutely right. If other countries can provide these high quality healthcare systems, well, so can we. You know, and we have in the past, the National Cancer Strategy, the screening services. There have been good initiatives here in the past that have worked very well and that have saved an awful lot of lives. And we need to remember how to do that. My sense is part of the problem here is that decision making has become too centralised, right? So you can have a nursing manager in an emergency department in Cork, and he or she may say, well, we need two emergency medicine nurses. They have to fill out about three or four forms. That has to be run up through the management structures within the hospital. Then that has to be sent up to Stephen's Hospital here in Dublin. They have to go through a process. It can take a year just for that nursing manager.
Does that save money by not filling the vacancy, or do you end up actually having to spend money to bring a temporary person in to do it?
Yeah,
that might cost more.
Yeah, you see, it costs much more. So two things happen, right? First of all, you got to bring in the agency nurse, which is more expensive. And anyone working in emergency medicine will tell you, you want the same team, you want to be working with the same people all the time. And the other thing it does, Matt, is it delays care. So if any manager is having to bring in agency, the waiting lists go up, people get sicker. And instead of treating someone when they begin to get sick, we end up, the doctors, the nurses end up treating them when they're much sicker. And that, of course, requires more money again.
Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin, you worked within the health system. So many of these things that we hear seem so obvious to be done. From your experience, why don't they get done?
Well, I just want to correct one thing. Susan said that it was Stephen and Roisin that were on the committee. It was actually myself and Roisin that were. Stephen wasn't a member of the committee that came up with the Sláinte Care report. So I just wanted to correct that, if you don't mind. I think part of the reason why we keep coming up against blockages within the health service is a failure to listen to frontline staff. So, I mean, we're effectively operating under a recruitment moratorium at the moment. I mean, they can put any words they like on it, but we know that there is an effective ban on recruitment. Now, anyone working in frontline healthcare will tell you that what you save by not recruiting staff, which, I mean, it is ludicrous where there's a capacity problem, you end up spending more on agency and locum staff. So last year, for example, the bill for agency was €330 million. Now, that bill has been growing all of the time. So we're dealing with recruitment.
Louise, do we know that if we hadn't hired those agency staff, if there had been people in full-time positions within the HSE, how much money would have been saved?
Well, it's hard to know because they're all paid at a different rate of pay. But as a rule of thumb, you could save between one third and one half of that bill. Because that's the cost of agency, and in a market like we have at the moment, the agency has the upper hand because obviously the staff are needed. Stephen makes a very valid point about recruitment. So if you give the director of nursing at local level the authority to recruit, which, you know, I don't want to get into party political points about this, but it was taken from local level the last time Fianna Fáil were in government and they put in the moratorium. You do have to have this elongated process. And in the intervening time, what happens is a nurse will get an offer of a job either abroad or with an agency immediately, or she can wait for paperwork. So, I mean, I had a case of people within my own constituency, two nurses married to each other, moved back to Ireland on the promise of a job for both of them. Both of them absolutely needed, and yet they couldn't, the paperwork was killing them. They were paying rent, which was crucifying them, and they were waiting. And all of the while, the hospital in England where they had been working was sending them emails twice a week saying, we really want you to come back. We will offer you a financial incentive. The message that they got from the health service was, we actually don't want you. You know, we don't want you as a permanent employee. We're going to mess you around. And what happens when you take the authority to recruit from local level, you then have all of that elongated okay. process all the way up to Manor Hamilton. And the other thing, of course, which can and should be done is if you talk to frontline healthcare professionals about task transfer, and I can tell you, if you talk to the INMO, you talk to anybody representing nurses, midwives or allied health professionals, they're up for the challenge of task transfer. They're up for increasing what they do and handing over tasks so that it can be done in a more efficient
way. OK, we're continuing our debate on what needs to be done to solve our health crisis. Susan Mitchell, one of the major issues in the emergency departments is that people can't get into the hospital because there aren't beds in the hospital because people haven't been discharged. It can be sometimes 600 people in our hospitals on any given day waiting for discharge. They're not all waiting for step-down care facilities, are there? Could there be other issues which are delaying their discharge?
So some of them are waiting for home care supports. Some of them are waiting for nursing home beds under the Fair Deal, the state's Fair Deal nursing home scheme. Others might be waiting for a rehabilitative bed to help with their rehabilitation if they need some help after, say, having a stroke or whatever kind of indication they've been admitted for in the first instance. So it's a mix really of what they need. But, you know, as you rightly point out, Matt, you know, on any given day, there can be anywhere between 500, 600, 700 even on occasion people waiting. So in other words, doctors have determined that they're fit for discharge and they can't get out.
Yeah, are there lots of people, and I've had experiences that you're itching to go and you're waiting to be discharged.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, because when we're talking about, you know, the number of beds, of acute hospital beds we have, and a lot of people are calling for an increase in acute hospital beds, we definitely have a low number, but should we be prioritising home care packages, rehabilitation beds, etc. first?
It's a no-brainer. Provide places and speed up the discharge of people to allow people from the emergency departments.
The way things happen at the moment makes no sense at all. You know, and we talk about the need to provide extra beds. We do, undoubtedly. They're very expensive. But the first thing we should be doing is ensuring that all available beds are freed up. So we have this number on any one day, as Susan said, 700 people who are ready to be discharged, but there isn't funding for home care or for step down. And the reason for that
is... It's not a false economy.
It's an absolute false economy. You know, that's why we have to move to a lower cost model of care. Again, that's what Sláinte Care is about. But the reason that that happens, Matt, is very clear. There's one budget for the hospitals and there's another budget for community care. And the two of them don't meet at all.
Well, why not? Because they're clearly linked.
Because that's how we organise the health service at the moment. And that's why the recommendation is that on a regional basis, you would have a single budget. So money would be spent in areas that make the most sense and give you the greatest value for money. At the moment, hospitals will not give up some of their budget in order to get home care services.
I give you a direct example that I experienced myself in Vincent's Hospital recently with somebody, and they were discharged. They needed home care. The social worker came, said, there's none, you're going to have to stay in the bed. And we said, well, how long is he going to have to stay in the bed? And she said, 3 months. 3 months in a bed in St. Vincent's. They had about half the staffing levels they needed in the wards and so forth. So
okay, because there's another one here. A listener says, I've been in hospital waiting, visiting my wife every day for the last 5 months. And I can tell you firsthand that in the 5 day week system that has the HSE screwed, from 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon until Monday morning at Limerick Regional Hospital, it's like a ghost town. Everything happens on the Monday to Friday basis. Louise O'Reilly, are there issues? Well, another listener says people are not being discharged because they're waiting for tests to be done because of the backlog about getting tests done because they're only done on a 9-to-5 basis.
No, there's not. And in fact, any industrial relations issues that there were with that in relation to contracts, etc., were worked out as part of the National Wage Agreement going back to 2005. What there is, though, is there's a shortage of staff. So you can't operate a service on a 24/7 basis if you only have the staff for 8 hours a day. That's a fact. That's why the urgent care centre in Connolly is only open from 10 until 5 instead of 8 a.m. until midnight, which is what people were promised. Not because there's any failing on the part of the staff, not because there's any contractual issues or indeed industrial relations issues. What there is a lack of staff. So if you have the staff to fully staff the hospital, well, then the hospital can and will operate on a 24-hour a day, 7 day a week basis at full capacity. Unfortunately, we don't have that situation. We have a chronic shortage of staff, which is why in our alternative budget for the last 4 years, Sinn Féin have prioritised frontline healthcare staff in terms of recruitment to ensure that we can manage that deficit and that we can operate those services to max capacity.
But Louise, where are you going to get all these people from? And the hospital consultants, recently the government has talked about increasing the amount of pay that goes to public-only hospital consultants. But I saw you last night on Clare Byrne Live and RT talking about higher taxes for people earning over €100,000 or a figure like that. Certainly the consultants would be caught in that. Are you really confident that hospital consultants would be happy with the rate of pay they're offered, given the availability of private hours to them, if they're going to be paying significantly higher taxes?
Hospital consultants will be happy, and I know this because I've spoken to them, to see someone take on the problems in the health service head on, to end the pay inequality so that we can ensure that we can recruit more hospital consultants and to put money back in their pockets by tackling the cost of living. I don't think we need to get hung up on an argument about taxation rates, because that is certainly not what doctors are saying. In fact, if you look at the survey done by the IMO, they will tell you that pay is a factor. It absolutely is. But working conditions also, lack of access to training, lack of continuing professional development, not being able to have any free time, being almost constantly on call. These are the issues. Quality of life and poor working conditions are also serious
okay.
issues.
Okay. Roisin Shortall, would you agree with Louise's analysis of that?
Yes, I would. And surveys have actually shown that. We have a problem with recruitment and retention right across the board in the health service in relation to doctors. Obviously, with consultants, the whole thing of two-tier pay needs to be addressed and is being addressed now, actually, in terms of the new contracts. But the 500 vacant contracts that are there at the moment need to be filled as well under those new terms of public only. The other thing in relation to GPs, obviously there were...
Are there 500 doctors there to actually fill those positions?
Well, I'll explain that. We're
very
told that there aren't. There aren't at the moment. And the difficulty is that we recruit, we train a lot of healthcare staff at quite a bit of expense to the taxpayer in this country, trained to a very high level. The problem is that an awful lot of them head off to the States or Australia or wherever, all around the world, because of the fact that our health service is a very difficult place to work. People want, you know, better quality of life. They don't want to be working the kind of long hours that hospital doctors
are. Okay, that's much
are.
The point that Louise has
yes,
made.
Yes, very Louise similar. So it's pay
error.
And okay. conditions
there
and stress.
There is a critical error in the government's approach and what Roisin has said to tying this new entrant pay inequality into a new consultant contract. A new consultant contract is going to take a long time. There's a million people waiting for healthcare.
Okay.
We need to hire now. So one of the things we need to do is we need to reverse new entrant pay inequality. You know, it's all well and good us saying, you know, we want to hire 1,000 consultants. Fianna Fáil's manifesto, we want 800 to 1,000 consultants, 4,000 new nurses. But the reality is we will only be able to hire them and keep the ones we have if it is a good place to work.
Very
so we
brief.
Need
How
action
much that,
now.
Susan Mitchell?
I think it's going to take a long time to improve working conditions in the health service. And I don't think it's realistic to expect that we're going to turn around the recruitment and retention problem for consultants without tackling the pay issue in a more meaningful
and Susan,
way.
And Susan, what about
right.
general practitioners? Because looking at the Business Post of the weekend, you were making the point that there are something like 85 additional GPs from 5 years ago in the public system at present who actually take public patients, whatever.
Exactly.
Right. How is the government going to deliver all of these additional free services for up to under 18s?
Well, it's a huge issue, because the government has increased the number of training places for GPs. So there are more doctors now studying to be GPs. But like specialists, like hospital specialists, they too are upping sticks to work overseas, because again, the quality of life is better, their working life is a lot easier, and the money is a lot better than it is here.
Well, money isn't necessarily a factor, okay?
Well, Roisin, we can disagree on that, because
it rates somewhere there.
I know,
but,
I know it's a,
but
it may
not
be the top
one.
Factor.
It's
I
not the only
okay,
one.
Well,
but it is a factor.
But the point I would make is that the key reason why highly trained people go abroad and it's so hard to get them back here is because they do not have confidence that we're actually going to reform the health service. Like, you know, there's this history of changing the plan every time there's a new minister or a new party in government. What they need, what people who are abroad now need to hear is that this, the next government is serious about reforming the health service, about making it into a proper universal single-tier public health service, and that they're actually going to fund that. And we need to give people the confidence to come back and participate in that reform
programme. Stephen Donnelly, can you see a day in the future, and how far out would it be if you can, in which people won't need to purchase private health insurance because they could be confident about getting all of the healthcare they need speedily and efficiently in the public system?
Yes, that would be total success. That is absolutely the
goal. How long is it going to take?
Well, Sláinte Care is 10 years. Let's hope that year after year after year as the public system gets better and better.
It's not in 10 years' time. It's each year incremental improvement.
So it's 10 years. People won't be getting rid of their private health insurance until 10 years' time, will they?
No,
but I think, Matt, as the system gets better and better and better and people say, look, there's a great system available to me, there's great doctors, there's great diagnostics, there's access when I need it. Do you know what? I don't need it. That is total success.
Louise O'Reilly, what role does Sinn Féin see for private medicine in the future, given that we have quite a significant number of private hospitals in the country?
Well, I think the what we would like to see is a universally accessible public health system that doesn't rely on the private sector to relieve pressure, or indeed that doesn't funnel money via the NDPF or any other mechanism out of the public health system and into private healthcare. Because universally accessible healthcare should be publicly funded and available to all citizens. One of the things,
and if that happens, then what's the role for the private hospitals?
One of the things that was very clear when we went to the Sláinte Care Committee.
Seriously? Look at the NHS.
If I could just finish, Roisin, what we spoke about was the need for people to be able to access healthcare without worrying about their bank balance. That is absolutely essential. That has to be our guide. The existence or otherwise of private healthcare as a top-up to an already decent system, I think that's absolutely... I don't have a difficulty with that if that's what people want. Why would people go to the private system if they're getting top-quality healthcare in the public service, which is what Sinn Féin wants to see?
There is an important point of difference, if I could say, Matt, though, because Louise and I disagree on this, which is the National Treatment Purchase Fund. So one of the things that Fianna Fáil is saying, yes, Sláinte Care, and here are our Sláinte Care priorities for the first 5 years, and at the same time, there's over 500,000 people in the country right now can't get access to a consultant. So one of the things we're saying is there's 100 million in this fund. Let's bring it up to 2 million over the next
five years
so that people can get the
Susan
care
Mitchell
they need
as our independent observer, with a comment that's come in from Dr. Mick Molloy, former president of the IMO, who's been listening and who says, Sláinte Care is 3 years in, very little investment so far, would need massive injection of funds this year and next. Otherwise, we'll be 5 years into a 10-year plan with little to show for it. Is that an accurate assessment?
I think it's a very accurate assessment because very little money has been put into the Sláinte Care Implementation Office. And finally, I think just on the public-private system or mix that we have, Matt, the Private Hospitals Association welcomed the news from the government that it was going, that it planned or it had approved the removal of private practice from public hospitals. So they're clearly not very concerned.
Susan Mitchell of the Business Post, Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin, Roisin Shortall of the Social Democrats and Stephen Donnelly of Fianna Fáil. Thank you all very much for being with us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.